I'm Marty Moscoe. Welcome to Radio Times. Most of us who live with dogs first meet them when they are either old enough to adopt or are adults looking for a home. We don't get to experience their first days when they just eat and sleep and can't see or hear a thing. Unlike human babies, though, their development happens quickly, and with a month or two, they are exploring and learning about the world around them, including the people in their lives. Our guest, canine researcher Alexandra Horowitz, adopted a puppy during the pandemic, like a lot of Americans. She first met Quid when she was being born, part of a litter of 11. Horowitz followed the dog's development, and when the time was right, Quid joined her family that included a husband, a child, two dogs, and a cat. Raising a puppy is work, and Quid was a handful, chewing on everything, barking at everyone, and turning their family life upside down. Horowitz documents all of this in her new book, The Year of the Puppy, where she admits she didn't love her dog at first and thought adopting her might have been a mistake. Spoiler alert, Quid is very much a part of the family, in fact, sitting at the feet of our guest for this interview. Alexandra Horowitz is Senior Research Fellow and Principal Investigator at the Horowitz Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College and joins us on Radio Times to talk about her new book, The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. And I think you've been on the show for all of your books. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's delightful to be here. Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. You say at the beginning of your book, your family really didn't need a puppy, and yet you ended up with one. How did that happen? Whose idea was this?
We really didn't. Yeah. I think I got the idea, as you mentioned, because, you know, we've never really met a dog, known a dog from the beginning of their life. And having adopted dogs several months or even years into their lives, we naturally wonder, you know, what their early days and weeks were like, how that might have shaped who they are, the who that they are that we meet in their advanced age. And I really wanted to see that development of the personality, you know, that becomes part of your family from the very beginning. And I had a, you know, young adolescent son myself, and I thought this is a great time to introduce another dog to our family. So it seemed at the time like a good idea.
And we will get to all of that. But was it primarily a research project? Or, I mean, it's hard to turn a dog living in the family into a research project, but nonetheless.
Yeah, at the same time, I'm always wearing, you know, my science hat, and I am interested in the science of early development in dogs. I haven't researched that myself much, and there isn't a huge amount of research out there about it, because most dog cognition researchers in particular are dealing with owned dogs who have to be, you know, with the family, the human family, not with their mother anymore, although this is beginning to change with some researchers. So I wanted to look at the science of early dog development with the same level of detail that I had looked at just dog mind generally in previous explorations.
This dog you named Quid, which is short for quiddity. I kept going to liquidity, but that's not what this name means. How did you end up with the name Quiddity?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of importance in naming a dog as part of bringing them into the fold of your family. And as a result, it was a, you know, cumulative effort of my family to try to come up with a name that we all thought was sort of matched the little mischievous sprite who was going to enter our home. And my son actually came up with Quid. And quiddity is the word that means the essence of a thing. And so I thought that's kind of a perfect name for her, but she probably would respond to liquidity if you shouted it out at the dog park.
What were some of the rejected names? I'm just curious about that.
Oh, we had other ones which I think would match a personality, like Zephyr was one. I was very keen on punctuation names. I really liked M dash. It's just a writer thing. It's a writer problem. But I loved that she could have multiple nicknames with a name like that.
She was one of, she was one of a litter of 11. That's a lot of puppies. Her mom was named Maisie, had been, living in Georgia and then brought up north to have her puppies. What do we know, need to know about Maisie?
She's one of these. She was named Maisie by the foster who took her in. She was rescued by a cattle dog rescue group when she had been surrendered at a shelter in Georgia somewhere. Maybe she'd been cared for, maybe she'd been found and turned in as a pregnant mom or to-be mom. A pretty young dog, but, you know, obviously alarmed at what was happening to her body. She was driven up to upstate New York where a woman who agreed to be her foster and foster her puppies was going to take her in, and she had her puppies almost right away. So she was probably overdue to have this litter. And a litter of 11 is a large litter, a surprising number of pups coming out of her.
Well, you were there to observe these pups, including Quid, being born. And talk about, I mean, I think we have seen pictures, or if we've been lucky enough to observe that ourselves, and you just see this sort of mountain of puppies. What is going on when they're first born?
You know, I met her right after she was born, and the puppies can do almost nothing, right? They're born at a rate of about 1 an hour, and the foster was there to help with several of them. But the mom is really responsible for cleaning them off, cleaning up the placenta, and getting them over to her belly to begin to suckle, because they are blind, they're deaf, they can't regulate their body temperature, they can barely move. I saw a little like toe stretching, and obviously they can suck with their mouths, but they can't even lift up their giant heads that much. So at that point, they're really not fully baked, you know, and mom needs to really assist them in getting clean and warm and fed.
And not unlike humans, correct?
Yes. In fact, you know, I mean, we're both altricial species, meaning we're very dependent on care, on parental care right away. And humans remain dependent for a much longer period of time. Surprisingly, within several weeks, these puppies are kind of bouncing around, although still dependent on mom. We're much more capable. Their developmental trajectory is much quicker than ours.
And when you have 11 puppies, is it survival of the fittest? Is that how it works?
It was interesting because, you know, the mom only typically has about 8 nipples. So there is a little bit of competition happening there, and the mom might assist with this, bringing in this puppy who's maybe not getting a nipple and missing several meals, or might not. In this case, since there was a person there regularly to sort of oversee and supervise the puppies, there was a lot of removing of the largest puppy and putting on the smallest puppy from a nipple. But it certainly is the case that in many letters, the smallest or weakest may not survive.
And especially, I would think, in the wild, I mean, there are dogs that live essentially in the wild, that would probably be more true.
Yes, it is true. And the rates of survival are much, much lower in the wild. At the same time, there are some free-ranging dog populations that have been studied where other sisters, sort of aunts of the new mom, sometimes also nurse the pups.
Wow.
Maybe not in the very first days, but in the weeks subsequently. So sort of serve as substitute nannies, as it were. And that does ensure that instead of only, you know, 20%, 50% of the litter living outside will survive.
Boy, that's quite something. You do not like the word bitch, nor do I, to describe a female dog. I don't know if that was ever felt like an appropriate word. What should we use instead?
Oh, it's still widely used to discuss female dogs, especially among breeders, people who are dealing with dogs professionally. And I just think it matters, you know, what words we use. I call Maisie a mom, which seems like an appropriate word to describe exactly what she's doing. the male is usually called stud, too, which seems also like a very unfair, inequitous arrangement.
Putting a lot of pressure on him, right?
Well, that's true. I mean, we know a stud as someone who's just going to supply, like, perfect sperm, perhaps. But males are usually not involved in the process after insemination, so I don't consider that very studly behavior. So, yeah, I think we can overthrow that language.
You say, actually, and I didn't know this, that a female cat is called a queen. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
Right. So I think maybe a cat was behind all this naming.
That makes total sense. You also say you don't like the word owner to describe us people who live with dogs. A better word is person?
That's what I use. This is certainly trend among dog people who, you know, that's what I call myself, a person who lives with a dog or a dog person. Guardian is often used as well. Some people say pet parents, and I only don't use that as much because I don't think of the relationship as a parent, pet or parent-child relationship. But I do think that my dog is, if I'm going to call her my dog, then I'm her person, so that sort of suits me.
You were describing, you know, the first couple of days of a puppy's life, and what is happening to their brain as they are nursing and I guess nursing and sleeping? That's essentially what little puppies do.
Yes, that is the entire orientation of their physical being, including their brain, in the very first days. They can't see, they can't hear, but they can smell. And they can navigate a little bit by touch. They're very sensitive to tactile stimulation. So their brain is being, is coming online just as a young human's brain is coming online with neural connections being formed, but with very limited stimuli at that point in their life, since there's so much just getting the body on board and running that has to happen.
About a minute before our first break here, but you describe, you know, what it is to hold. I mean, and there are certain ways, I guess, you should hold a tiny little puppy. How should we do that if we have the chance?
Yes. In fact, there's been research on this done by the U.S. government when they were aspiring to make more suitable working dogs. And it involves small challenges to the puppy. So, holding them gently and turning them a little upside down. Sort of as you might do to baby when you lift them up and put them over your head in a controlled way, putting them in situations that they're not going to get themselves so that their body and brain can learn how to restore their orientation.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about puppies today on Radio Times, and our guest is Alexandra Horowitz. She's got a brand new book. It's called The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. She is Senior Research Fellow, Principal Investigator at the Horowitz Dog Cognition Lab at Barnard College. This is her fifth book about dogs, and she's been a guest on Radio Times to talk about dogs. We want you to join our conversation. Any questions or comments or your own experiences of raising a puppy, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and today on the show we are talking about puppies, and our guest is dog cognition researcher Alexandra Horowitz, and her new book is titled The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. Let me read an email from Patricia who said, just an observation. Years ago, when our family beagle had a litter of four puppies, we were noticing distinct personalities in them just 2 days after their birth. When nursing one puppy would be more aggressive about getting to nurse than the other. We noticed the same thing with a litter of kittens very early on, distinct personalities. Have you seen this, Alexandra?
I think it's pretty unusual to see what I would describe as personality differences that early on, when they're really still just part of just an extension of that little community in the mother's womb 2 days after birth. But that doesn't mean there wouldn't be behavioral differences. And, you know, a great observer could see those differences. Whether they translate to later personality differences is something that, I guess, remains to be seen.
And what's the difference? I mean, since you raised that, and as a researcher, the difference between personality, I guess, and behavior, we tend to conflate the two.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. We see a behavior that looks like in this aggressive, one dog pushing ahead of another dog. That could be very circumstantial, right? The dog wants something else. It could be about that dyad's relationship. That dog feels like they should get something else before the other dog, right? Or sees that there's something to be gotten. It could be accidental, or it could be really constitutive of that dog's personality, that they always are pushing ahead of other dogs. But it's very hard to extrapolate just from one behavior to a personality, right? Just as with us, we definitely manifest our personality in our behavior, but that doesn't mean that every single or even handful of behaviors that we do are indelibly tied to our personality. Mm-hmm.
So for dogs or for puppies, when does their personality then begin to emerge? How old?
Yeah, actually, I don't know the scientific answer to that. I didn't feel that I saw personalities emerge until they were really able to move on their own capably, which was a couple of weeks into their life. And then you did see very different approaches, dogs who were much more interested in going toward people, for instance, dogs who were more likely to be solitary. A lot of dogs, you know, they said certainly all the puppies like being touching each other, right? Some had already were vocalizing and others were not. So you started seeing little differences that I still would hesitate to call personalities, but certainly the personalities are being formed and they're starting to express themselves.
I mean, it's so easy, especially with dogs and probably cats as well, to anthropomorphize. I mean, to see things that may not be there.
It's a natural tendency of all of us, scientists included, to just to sort of immediately attribute things to other living beings that sort of match what we think would be happening if that was a person. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're not right. And I guess the job of the scientist is to try to distinguish between those occasions or try to show over lots of individuals when our attributions are correct and when they're not.
This was clearly, you know, a well-loved litter of puppies, well taken care of. You were there. The woman who was taking care of the mother, Maze, was there as well. But I'm also thinking about puppies that grow up in, you know, in these what are they called, puppy farms or the, you know, the
puppy mills.
The puppy mills. Thank you very much. Yeah, the puppy mills, and sadly, Pennsylvania has some of them, where they don't get the kind of love and attention and maybe don't get held the way you just described.
Absolutely. You're going to see an effect of not having that close contact with mom and with their siblings and not having early interactions with humans and being handled in later behavior of those puppies, right? It does sort of come out again as anxiety or as overvigilance or compulsive behavior. So that's why it's so important to avoid viewing dogs as a commodity, you know, that we can just breed and put on and sell like objects on a shelf in the supermarket. You know, they're really, these early weeks of their life are really critical to having a well-adapted dog later in life.
We are talking about puppies today with canine researcher Alexandra Horowitz. And again, she's got a new book. It's called The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. And it is about dog development, but also about a particular dog that she and her family adopted named Quid. And again, you can join our conversation. Any questions or comments, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. You can always call the old-fashioned way and pick up the phone. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You've written a whole book about dogs, just amazing noses and sense of smell. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about puppies, help us understand the development of their ability to have such an amazing nose.
Their nose is on right away, and it's really the only sensory organ which is helping them find their way. They can find their way to the smell of mom and to dinner via their nose during those days and weeks, really, before their eyes and ears are fully functional. That said, it does serve a different purpose in those early weeks than it will later on. They're really using their noses to navigate, to survive. And later in life, when they do have a lot more sensory apparatuses, they use them in combination. So we don't know that much about what the experience is like for the puppies, but a puppy who was born without a sense of smell would definitely be unable to survive without assistance of their mom or humans.
And I'm assuming there have been puppies born without a sense of smell?
Presumably so. I don't know, actually. But if there was any damage to the nasal apparatus in birth or in utero, that could be sufficient to knock out a sense of smell, just as, you know, for instance, in this litter, there was a dog who turned out to be deaf. And that was presumably something that happened genetically. It wasn't an experience that they had. Her inevitable result was that she was going to be deaf.
You describe, and I've seen pictures of how a dog's tongue works, especially if they're lapping up a bowl of water. And obviously with a little puppy, you've got the mom who's licking her babies. Take us into the workings of a canine tongue.
What's kind of great is that the mom really does do a huge amount of work in getting the puppy going by licking them. It's as though she's licking them into life. You know, there's an old myth about mama bears licking their baby bears into life, literally. And that's what it looks like a mother dog is doing when you see her giving birth. Because the tongue actually stimulates the respiratory organs of the pup to start working. So that's kind of an incredible ability that the mom has. The puppies themselves are using the tongues mostly in the service of eating and consumption, at right. least for the first days.
Sure, sure. And obviously, as these puppies are growing up, they are developing their relationships with their siblings. And one can see them, you know, roughhousing and wrestling and playing with each other, pouncing on each other, barking. Do we know how puppies see their siblings?
There's an interesting transition that happens pretty early on in these puppies' lives, which is that the mother, who is the center of their world for the first couple of weeks, their son starts moving further and further away from them. And then their siblings really become the center of their world. And I don't even know if they would themselves see themselves as different than these other little creatures for their early weeks, right? They're constantly around, following, on top of, biting, rolling on, sleeping with each other. You know, I describe almost every time I would visit the pups, there was just a pile of puppies, right? They're almost all sleeping on each other and in contorted ways that makes you think they're part of like a group self for their first several weeks. And the result of that sort of physical circumstance is that when they do get more motor ability and they start following a noise that they hear, they start following each other and they learn quickly from other pups where to go, what to do, how to interact, where to pee, where to find food, etc. So there's a lot of social learning that comes from their siblings who are learning at the same time.
And this idea of group self, which is that, here I am anthropomorphizing puppies, that I'm not an individual puppy. I'm part of this gang of puppies.
You know, I think that's that's how it looks. That's my way of describing it. It's very hard to identify, you know, a sense of self in any animal who can't tell us, you know, that they think about themselves. But it certainly looks like they're functioning as like a little social community, not as the kind of individual dogs that we see them as humans. And, you know, when we look at a litter of puppies, also we're looking at the one or ones that we want to take away from that unit and bring into our home. So we see, our natural way of seeing, especially American seeing, is seeing as individuals. But those first weeks really do look like, yes, a group self, where they're not individuating each other.
You made a reference to working dogs, and you also followed some puppies that were part of the Penn Working Dog Center here in Philadelphia. And these are puppies raised to have jobs, essentially. How different is that kind of treatment and training and education of those particular dogs?
Well, what was great is that this was during the pandemic, so I was visiting via Zoom, but I got to eavesdrop basically on the raising by a foster mom as well of the puppies, of a dog who I had met before, Pinto, who was a working dog, who was trained at Penn. And they look exactly the same, right, from the beginning. I mean, this litter was a Labrador litter, so they were purebreds, so they looked physically more similar than the litter of mixed breeds that I was following and eventually adopted from within. But they just all behave like puppies, right? They're doing the same types of things. There's not like little organized soldier behavior on the heart of these working dog puppies. What changes is several weeks in, when the type of what we call socialization or exposure to the stimuli of the world that happens with them is a little more rigorous, as designed by the researchers and staff at the Working Dog Center. So they're exposed more carefully and assiduously to certain types of stimuli that they need to get used to, or to see what their reactions are, because it's part of building them up to do these very unusual jobs in all manner of conditions.
In fact, there was a lot of noises, vacuum cleaners, you know, TV shows, sort of noises that they were being introduced to.
Yeah, this socialization period, which is a really critical period in early animals' lives, and for dogs it starts at about 3 or 4 weeks and lasts for several weeks, is the time when they can be exposed to all manner of people and animals and sounds and smells and sensations agreeably, right? And their nervous system will just become accustomed to it, more or less, as part of the way the world is. So that's a great time to introduce lots of types of people, for instance, so that you don't wind up with a dog who's surprised to see a little toddler who behaves differently than an adult. Or if they're going to be around a lot of cats, that's a great time to introduce them to cats. They're not concerned about the difference between themselves and the cat. They just view that as the way the world is. So noises are a big part of it for working dogs, but also for dogs living in cities, for instance. You want them to be okay, whether they're not alarmed or made anxious by any manner of sounds. So NPR was always on at the foster's house in upstate New York. Right. Our puppy had a lot of exposure to NPR in her early weeks. And all manner of sounds, you know, the helicopters overhead, cars driving by, all of those are just going to be taken in by their nervous system and considered as usual, as normal.
Here's a question or a comment about noses. Again, this is from Glenn. He says, puppies have a heat center on their nose similar to what reptiles have. Is that true?
There's one study that came out of Hungary, I believe, where there's a great set of researchers doing research on canine cognition, which made a claim that hasn't been replicated yet, I think, that dogs were responsive to sort of ultraviolet light, so what we would consider heat, via their noses. And I think it's provocative. Mm-hmm. It hasn't, you know, it was just one study, and there are possible other interpretations for what was happening. I wouldn't dismiss the possibility that there are perceptual capacities in dogs or other animals that are beyond our understanding.
So looking at these puppies, and even with Quid, the puppy that you adopted, at what point do they begin to, again, I'm looking for the right word here, recognize a human in their life, a human being? Mm-hmm. Is there a point at which they look at us and say, oh, there you are? I was wondering who you were.
I didn't see you standing there. You were so tall. I think if they're exposed to people sitting on the floor or approaching them or feeding them from these early weeks of the socialization period, as both litters that I write about in the book were, they don't see anything extraordinary about humans at all. I mean, dogs, over the course of domestication, over the last tens of thousands of years, have changed maybe from some of their canine ancestors to just be more flexible in the types of species they will consider kind of what we'd call conspecific, or almost like members of our species, or, you know, familiar. And if they're exposed to any of these species early in life, then they sort of forever seem to be acclimated to them. So that's how we now have a sheepdog who, if exposed to sheep early in life, don't have a predatory response to sheep, don't have a surprised or anxious or aggressive response to sheep. They view sheep as like part of their community. If they ever have a surprise, like, oh, I didn't know you were there. If they're exposed very early on to humans of all sorts.
And that's, we're almost up on a break here, but that seems sort of unique to dogs to have this, as you say, this kind of flexible, identification?
Yes. I mean, a lot of animals have a little bit of flexibility in this case, but the amount that the dogs have, the agreeableness with which they accept other species is way off the charts.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation talking with Alexander Horowitz about puppies and about dogs. And again, she's got a brand new book. It's called The Year of the Puppy, and it's subtitled How Dogs Become Themselves. For about 20 years, she's been doing cognition research with dogs. So any questions or comments about our best friends, you can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and just a recap, especially if you are just joining us, our guest Alexandra Horowitz has been studying dogs for more than 20 years. She runs the Horowitz Dog Cognition Lab that's at Barnard College and has written a number of books about what she has learned about our canine friends. During the pandemic, she began observing a litter of puppies from the day that they were born. She adopted one named Quid, and she did watch this scruffy, rambunctious little dog turn her family's life upside down. She's written her fifth book about dogs, and it's titled The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. And interestingly, she was guided in part by the work of psychologist Piaget, who studied his own children to understand human development. Well, Alexandra, let's talk about adopting Quid. Out of all these 11 puppies, why Quid?
Right. You know, I realized, first of all, I didn't know I was going to adopt a puppy out of this litter. I was just observing litters as part of my general research on early dog development. But then the pandemic really hit us. Everyone went into quarantine. This litter was about 5 weeks old, and I realized, oh, this is the litter I'm going to have to get our puppy out of. And so then this other thought, just beyond just observing the pups and being entertained and amused and delighted by their behavior, entered my mind, which was, you know, which one is the perfect one for us? And that was, of course, a very fraught question. And it wasn't at all obvious to me that even, you know, with some degree of attention to dog behavior, I'd say that I'd be able to choose the pup who was best matched to kind of our personalities and our lifestyle and the other animals who we already lived with. And in the end, it turned out I didn't completely get a choice. The foster had met all the potential adopters of the pups and tried to place pups with the people she thought they'd fit best with. And so we had a choice of a couple, and I was interested in maybe having a little female energy among in our house. I live with a boy and a man and two male dogs.
Oh, yeah.
And we basically chose the female of the couple that we were offered, that she thought matched us, Amy, the wonderful foster mom to this mom and litter, considered Quid, the dog we named Quid, to be happy-go-lucky. And thought that would suit us very well, which I thought was fascinating. You know, what that speaks to is that there clearly are differences that you start to see by this age. I mean, this is 8 or 9 weeks into their life. But they're certainly not determinative. You know, they aren't inevitable. They aren't changeable. They're still very adaptable to different environments. But she was less anxious and maybe more flexible and open than some of the other pups.
You do write, though, that early on, and you know, bringing home a puppy is in certain ways like bringing home a baby. It's a lot of work, but you do, and it almost took my breath away. You say, you know, I don't really love this dog yet, and maybe it was a mistake to adopt this dog, that it actually was, and you're a dog researcher, that it was a struggle to figure out how to get this dog comfortable inside your family, I guess, and vice versa.
You know, the funny thing is that I'm always advising people who come to me, you know, in the days after they adopt a puppy and are just at their wit's end and so concerned that they've made a mistake. And I'm always advising people to be a little patient, right? That it's that they'll move through this stage, right? But that this is the moment of the collision of our expectations, that things are just going to go easily and beautifully well, with the reality of having a completely new little creature who's entering a very novel situation for them and doesn't really know how to behave and is just behaving in all directions. And I could take some of my own advice. You know, I had the same experience, which was that it was a difficult transition for me. And I should say mostly just for me, the other people in my family really, you know, just completely enjoyed living with the puppy from day one. But I think I was very aware, especially of the effect that an introduction of another dog, in this case, our third dog, had on all the relationships, right? And affected our two older dogs. They were about 12 and 12 and a half at the time, with whom I have, you know, just great relationships, and I've had such a strong attachment and admiration for these dogs. And I hated to disrupt some of those relationships, and I saw her as doing that. So partly my feeling was about the disruptive element, which wasn't about who the puppy was at all. And then I found that over the year, it was a little bit more about starting to appreciate her for who she was, as everybody finds their way once chaos has started to settle.
I mean, did you feel a little guilty about disrupting them, these dogs' lives?
For sure.
For sure.
Absolutely.
These older ones who kind of knew the drill, right?
Yeah. I mean, and Finnegan, who has been in every one of my books, I would say, even a book that isn't about dogs, Finnegan is in that book. He has suffered the indignation of having a young baby, you know, just displace him from the center of our lives, and then another dog and a cat, and then this, you know, just seemed like the final straw for him. And I really felt for him. I wanted to be attentive to their needs in this case, and the result was that we just did really wind up making more individual space with each of the animals instead of just adding a member to our pack.
And you wrote a lovely obituary for your dog who died earlier this year.
Yeah, Finnegan died in January. Thank you. And I gave him an obituary, which I think all dogs are due. And then Upton died a month later.
Aw.
I'm sorry to say. And so we really, you know, now Quid is 2.5 and her life has been turned upside down again. Now she's the sole dog in the family.
You write, and you mentioned the fact that people come to you as a dog researcher saying, you know, for advice. The only advice that you have, which you include in this book, is requirements. Number one, expect that your puppy will not be who you think nor act as you hope. Period.
That's it. Yep. That's the entire list. I think that we come in with a lot of, I think what's difficult for people is in bringing a new animal into their house is that we come in with a lot of expectations. You know, in culture today, puppies are coming to us with some kind of reputation of what kind of personality they're going to be. Oh, this dog is friendly or really good with kids. And we see there's a lot of visual evidence online and just out, looking out the window of cooperatively behaving dogs. And so we don't see, you know, the private life of those dogs, and we don't see the time that it took for the dog and the family to really be woven together, right? And for me, the best thing that I did was start just being interested in who she was for her own sake and dropping expectations I had that she would be like my other dogs or that, she, you know, for other people that she they would behave obediently or cooperatively. I think that gets in the way of the appreciation of this new creature in your life.
You also make a distinction between training a dog and teaching a dog. What's the difference? What's the difference?
Well, I think training is sort of mispitched, that it should be considered teaching. And just the way that we teach our children, we're explicitly teaching them certain things that are important, like you don't put that in your mouth or, you know, here's when you stop before, that's a street, you stop before crossing the street. And there's certain things that are important to explicitly train or teach a dog to do as well. But the most of what's going to happen that's going to make the child grow into a magnificent human or a dog grow into a member of your family is just being sensitive to each other's like different worldview, not explicitly teaching them anything, and realize, you know, how weird it is for a little baby or for a puppy to come into a like already organized human home. It's not like they understand what that's about. So just helping them learn about that in a safe way versus explicitly teaching them tricks seems to me would be an interesting emphasis difference, which we could benefit from.
Let me read a couple more comments. Dan says, our first dog was able to tell my wife when I was coming home 10 minutes before I even showed up at the door, even though I worked very irregular hours. We have a new puppy that is starting to show signs of knowing when I'm on my way home. And Dan is curious whether you could talk about this. What do you think?
It's such an interesting question. And there are lots of stories. Many people do feel that their dogs are anticipating their return home. And I think they are legitimately right that the dog's behavior is changing in anticipation of the person returning home. And there isn't any kind of scientific consensus about what's happening there. One possibility is that there are a lot of other changes. And my personal belief is that there are a lot of other changes during the day that lead you to believe that someone's about to come home, right? That they're marking time in various ways that we might not be sensitive to. The same way that they're really sensitive to when it's time to eat dinner, right? They're not watching the clock, they just know. And that's more the same time every day, but that's because they are noticing the change of light or smell in the day. They have an internal biological rhythm which notifies them. It could also be that, in this case, his partner is doing some behaviors which unconsciously doing behaviors which alert the dog to the potential arrival of the person who's been away. You know, I don't know. It's absolutely mysterious and very tough to study across individuals, but I'd love to know the answer to that myself.
Yeah, but what I hear you saying, though, is that that the dogs that we live with are watching us. They're watching us.
Exactly. Yeah. I used to, I think, refer to them as anthropologists among us, because it's as though they're sitting in the corner, you know, observing us through the day. And in fact, they are. They become very sensitive to the difference between my getting up, you know, to go for a walk or my getting up to go to the fridge. And I don't think I'm doing anything different. I don't think I'm sending out any cues, but they have started to notice all the little cues that tell them about what's going to happen, because we do control, you know, a lot of their life. So they notice things about us which we might not be aware of.
Yeah. LJ asks, saying, I raised a puppy with my ex, but when we broke up, I gave her the dog with the idea that I could visit and, quote unquote, borrow him some. Is it unhealthy for my dog to see me now and again because he absolutely loses his mind when I show up? It seems almost stressful, and he is crushed when I leave. Now, you know, we're asking you to get into the mind of his dog, but what do you think based on behavior?
Yeah, it is exactly as you say. It's very hard for me to say whether it's more positive or negative, but I do think that that positive excitement on seeing the person is legitimate and also is an addition to the dog's life, right? I think having a larger social community, and that includes just knowing different people and staying with different people, is usually positive for dogs, you know. And of course, I can't speak to every dog in every situation, but you know, I've known a lot of relationships which have involved the kind of dog share. You know, if they've split up, the dogs, you know, has two homes, and in most cases, I think that's positive because they get to be a little bit the center of that person's life for a short time. Different dynamic, different walks, different smells, different dogs, and different interaction with the person, right? So my guess is that that's positive. In any event, I think it probably is also very good for the person.
Sure.
I would keep it up.
Fair enough. You put a GoPro on Quid just, I guess, to see how she sees the world. And when you looked at the video, what did you see?
What I love about doing this is that even though I've spent a career trying to understand the point of view of the dog, but just getting to their level actually goes a huge amount of the way towards starting to understand how incomplete, you know, my understanding from my 5'8" height is of what it's like for her. So you really see the experience, you know, a foot or a foot and a half off the ground, and how the tall grasses are, you know, like a forest, like a jungle. The thing that surprised me most, though, was how much we were at the center of her vision, right? She really looked to me at this point in her life like she was interested in everything but us as soon as we got outside. And that concerned me because I didn't want her to run off. I didn't want her to get lost or get run onto a neighboring street or, you know, but seemed like she was after the squirrel, the sound in the forest, everything but us. But if you look at the vantage through this camera, she's always looking at us. You know, she's always keeping us in her sights. We're often right in the center of her gaze. And I thought that was interesting, you know, just a note, an observation about how the rubber band of connection between you and your dog is felt differently to them than to you. You know, many people want their dog to walk right by their side, and that's the only kind of acceptable distance between them. But dogs are often fine walking quite a distance, but they're still keeping you in mind. You know, they feel attached to you. It's just that we don't feel attached to them at that distance. And so I liked seeing that difference in our perspective.
Well, we have to leave it there. And as always, a great pleasure to talk with you about dogs. Alexandra Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're very welcome. And her new book is titled The Year of the Puppy, How Dogs Become Themselves. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and we close things out with Cat Stevens and his song, I Love My Dog.
I love my dog as much as I love you. But you may think my dog will always come through. All he asks from me is the food to give him strength. All he ever needs is love, and that he knows he'll get. So I love my dog as much as I love you. But you make a fame, my dog will always come through.
All the pay I need comes a shining through his eyes. I don't need no cold water to make me realize.